Cassette 15, Side 2.
Jackie's face took on its world-weary look, as if Zoe's analysis of the situation were the work of a child, as if there were hidden sources of political power on Mercury, of all places. It was irritating, but Zoe restrained herself and didn't show her irritation. Antar came in, looking for them. He saw them and smiled, came over and gave Jackie a quick kiss, Zoe a longer one. He and Jackie conferred for a while about something or other, in whispers, and then Jackie told him to leave. There was a great deal of the will to power in Jackie, Zoe saw once again, ordering Antar around gratuitously. It was a flaunting of power that one saw in many Nisei women. Women who had grown up in patriarchies and therefore reacted virulently against them. They didn't fully understand that patriarchy no longer mattered, and perhaps never had, that it had always been caught in the kegel grip of uterine law, which operated outside patriarchy with a biological power that couldn't be controlled by any mere politics. The female hold on male sexual pleasure, on life itself. These were realities for patriarchs, as much as anyone, despite all their repression, their fear of the female, which had been expressed in so many ways, purda, clitoridectomy, foot binding, and so on. Ugly stuff indeed. A desperate, ruthless last-ditch defense, successful for a time, certainly, but now blown away without a trace. Now the poor fellows had to fend for themselves, and it was hard. Women like Jackie had them whipped, and women like Jackie liked to whip them. "I want you to go out to the Uranian system," Jackie was saying. "They're just settling out there, and I want to get them early. You can pass along a word to the Galileans as well. They're getting out of line." "I should do a co-op stint," Zoe said, "or it will become too obvious that it's a front." After many years of running with a feral co-op based in Looney, Zoe had joined one of the co-ops that functioned in part as a front for Free Mars, allowing Zoe and other operatives to do party work without it becoming obvious that that was their principal activity. The co-op Zoe had joined built and installed crater screens, but she hadn't worked for them in any real job for over a year. Jackie nodded. "Put in some time, then take another leave, in a month or so." "Okay." Zoe was interested in seeing the outer satellites, so it was easy to agree. But Jackie only nodded, showing no sign of awareness that Zoe might not have agreed. Her mother was not a very imaginative person when all was said and done. No doubt Zoe's father was the source of that quality in Zoe. God bless him. Zoe did not want to know his identity, which at this point would only have been an imposition on her freedom. But she felt a surge of gratitude to him for his genes, her salvation from pure Jackiness. Zoe stood, too tired to take her mother any longer. "You look tired and I'm beat," she said. She kissed Jackie on the cheek as she went off to her room. "I love you. Maybe you should think about getting the treatment again." Her co-op was based in Moru Crater in the Proto-Nihilus Mensae, between Mangala and Bradbury Point. It was a big crater, puncturing the long slope of the Great Escarpment as it fell down toward the Boone's Neck Peninsula. The co-op was always developing new varieties of molecular netting to replace earlier nets and the old tent fabrics. The mesh they had installed over Moru was the latest thing. The polyhydroxybutyrate plastic of its fibers, harvested from soybean plants, engineered to produce the PHB in the plant's chloroplasts. The mesh held in the equivalent of a daily inversion layer, which made the air inside the crater about 30% thicker and considerably warmer than the outside air. Nets like this one made it easier to get biomes through the tough transition from tent to open air, and when permanently installed, they created nice mesoclimates at higher altitudes or latitudes. Moru extended up to 43 degrees north, and winters outside the crater were always going to be fairly severe. With the mesh in place, they were able to sustain a warm, high-altitude forest sporting an exotic array of plants engineered from the East African volcanoes, New Guinea, and the Himalayas. Down on the crater floor in the summer, the days were seriously hot, and the weird, blooming, spiky trees as fragrant as perfume. The crater's inhabitants lived in spacious apartments dug into the northern arc of the rim, in four setback levels of balconies and broad window walls, overlooking the green fronds of the Kilimanjaro slope forest underneath them. The balconies baked in the sun in the winter and rested under vine-covered trellises in the summer when daytime temperatures soared to 305K and the people muttered about changing to a coarser mesh to allow more hot air to escape, or even working up a system where they could simply roll off the mesh during the summer. Zoe spent most of every day working on the outer apron or under it, grinding out as much of a full work stint as she could before it came time to leave for the outer satellites. The work this time was interesting, involving long trips underground in mining tunnels, following veins and layers in the crater's old splosh apron. The impact brecciation had created all kinds of useful metamorphic rock, and greenhouse gas minerals were a common secondary find throughout the apron. The co-op was therefore working on new methods of mining, as well as extracting some feedstocks for mesh looms, hoping to make marketable improvements in mining methods that would leave the surface undisturbed while the regolith under it was still being mined intensively. Most of the underground work was of course robotic, but there were various human optimum tasks still, as there always would be in mining. Zoe found it very satisfying to spelunk in the dim sub-Martian world, to spend all day in the bowels of the planet between great plates of rock, in caves with their close, rough black walls gleaming with crystals, the powerful lights exploding off them, to check samples and explore newly cut galleries, in a forest of dull magnesium uprights jammed into place by the robot excavators, to work like a troglodyte seeking rare treasure underground, and then to emerge from the elevator car, blinking madly at the sudden sunlight of late afternoon, the air bronze or salmon or amber as the sun blazed through the purpling sky like an old friend, warming them as they trudged up the slope of the apron to the rim gate, where the round forest of Moreux lay below them, a lost world home to jaguars and vultures. Once inside the mesh, there was a cable car that dropped on looping wires to the settlement, but Zoe usually went instead to the gatehouse and got her bird suit out of its locker and slipped into it and zipped up and ran off a flyer's platform and spread her wings and flew in lazy spirals down to the North Rim town to dinner on one of the dining terraces, watching parrots and cockatiels and lorikeets dart about trying to scavenge a meal. For work, it wasn't bad. She slept well. One day a group of atmospheric engineers came by to see how much air was escaping through the Moreux mesh in the midday summer heat. There were a lot of old ones in the group, people with the blasted eyes and diffuse manner of the longtime field aerologist. One of these Issei was Sax Russell himself, a small, bald man with a crooked nose and skin as wrinkled as that of the tortoises clomping around the crater floor. Zoe stared and stared at the old man, one of the most famous people in Martian history. It was bizarre to have such a figure out of the books saying hello to her, as if George Washington or Archimedes might dart her by next. The dead hand of the past still there, living among them, perpetually dumbfounded by all the latest developments. Russell certainly appeared dumbfounded. He looked thoroughly stunned through the whole orientation meeting and left the atmospheric inquiries to his associates and spent his time staring down at the forest below the town. When someone at dinner introduced Zoe to him, he blinked at her with a tortoise's dim cunning.
"I taught your mother once."
"Yes," Zoe said.
"Will you show me the crater floor?" he asked.
"I usually fly over it," Zoe said, surprised.
"I was hoping to walk," he said, and looked at her, blinking.
The novelty value was so great that she agreed to join him. They started out in the cool of the morning, following the shade under the eastern rim. Balsa and sal trees intersected overhead, forming a high canopy through which lemurs howled and leaped. The old man walked slowly along, peering at the heedless creatures of the forest, and he spoke seldom, mostly to ask if Zoe knew the names of the various ferns and trees. All she could identify for him were the birds. "The names of plants go in one ear and out the other, I'm afraid," she admitted cheerfully. His forehead wrinkled at this. "I think that helps me to see them better," she added.
"Really?"
He looked around again, as if trying it.
"Does that mean you don't see the birds as well as the plants?"
"They're different. They're my brothers and sisters. They have to have names. It's part of them. But this stuff..." She gestured at the green fronds around them, giant ferns under spiky flowering trees. "This stuff is nameless, really. We make up names, but they don't really have them." He thought about this.
"Where do you fly?" he said, a kilometer down the overgrown trail.
"Everywhere."
"Do you have favorite places?"
"I like Ekus Overlook."
"Good updrafts?"
"Very good. I was there until Jackie descended on me and put me to work."
"It's not your work?"
"Oh, yes, yes. But my co-op is good at flex time."
"Ah, so you will stay here a while?"
"Only until the Galilean shuttle leaves."
"Then you will emigrate?"
"No, no, a tour for Jackie. Diplomatic mission."
"Ah, will you visit Uranus?"
"Yes."
"I'd like to see Miranda."
"Me too. That's one reason I'm going."
"Ah."
They crossed a shallow creek, stepping on exposed flat stones. Birds called, insects whirred. Sunlight filled the entire crater bowl now, but under the forest canopy it was still cool, the air shot with parallel columns and wires of slanting yellow light. Russell crouched to stare into the creek they had crossed. "What was my mother like as a child?" Zoe asked.
"Jackie?"
He thought about it. A long time passed. Just as Zoe was concluding with exasperation that he had forgotten the question, he said,
"She was a fast runner. She asked a lot of questions. Why? I liked that. She was the oldest of that generation of ectogenes, I think. The leader, anyway."
"Was she in love with Nergal?"
"I don't know. Why, have you met Nergal?"
"I think so, yes. With the Ferals once." "What about with Peter Claiborne? Was she in love with him?"
"In love? Later, maybe, when they were older. In Zygote, I don't know."
"You aren't much help."
"No."
"Forgotten it all?"
"Not all. But what I remember is hard to characterize. I remember Jackie asking about John Boone one day, just in the way you're asking about her, more than once. She was pleased to be his granddaughter. Proud of him."
"She still is, and I'm proud of her."
"And I remember her crying once."
"Why? And don't say I don't know."
This balked him.
Finally, he looked up at her with a smile almost human.
"She was sad."
"Oh, very good."
"Because her mother had left. Esther."
"That's right."
"Cassay and Esther broke up, and Esther left for... I don't know, but Cassay and Jackie stayed in Zygote, and one day she got to school early on a day I was teaching. She asked why a lot, and this time too, but about Cassay and Esther. And then she cried."
"What did you say to her?"
"I don't... nothing, I suppose. I didn't know what to say. I thought she perhaps should have gone with Esther, The mother bond is crucial. Come on. You don't agree? I thought all you young natives were sociobiologists.
What's that?
Someone who believes that most cultural traits have a biological explanation.
Oh, no, of course not. We're much freer than that. Mothering can be any kind of thing. Sometimes mothers are nothing but incubators.
I suppose so.
Take my word for it.
But Jackie cried.
On they hiked in silence. Like a lot of the big craters, Moreux turned out to have several pie-wedge watersheds converging on a central marsh and lake. In this case, the lake was small and kidney-shaped, curving around the rough, low knobs of a central peak complex. Zoe and Russell came out from under the forest canopy on an indistinct trail that faded into elephant grass, and they would have gotten quickly lost except for the stream, which was oxbowing through the grass toward a meadow and then the marshy lake. Even the meadow was dominated by elephant grass, great circular clumps of it that stood well overhead, so that they often had a view of nothing but giant grasses and sky. The long blades of grass gleamed under the lilac midday zenith. Russell stumbled along well behind Zoe, his round sunglasses like mirrors in his face, reflecting the grass bundles as he looked this way and that. He appeared utterly foxed, amazed at the surroundings, and he muttered into an old wrist pad that hung on his wrist like a manacle. A final oxbow into the lake had created a fine sand and pebble beach, and after testing with a stick for quicksand at the waterline and finding the sand firm, Zoe stripped off her sweaty singlet and walked out into the water, which got nice and cold a few meters offshore. She dove under, swam around, hit her head on the bottom. There was a beached boulder standing over some deep water, and she climbed it and dove in three or four times, doing a forward flip in the water right after entry. This forward somersault, difficult and graceless in the air, caused a quick little tug of weightless pleasure in the pit of her stomach, a feeling as close to orgasm as any non-orgasm she had ever felt. So she dove several times until the sensation wore off and she was cooled. Then she walked out of the lake and lay on the sand, feeling its heat and the solar radiation cook both sides of her. A real orgasm would have been perfect, but despite the fact that she was laid out before him like a map of sex, Russell sat cross-legged in the shallows, absorbed apparently by the mud, naked himself except for sunglasses and wrist pad. A farmer-tanned little bald wizened primate, like her image of Gandhi or Homo habilis. It was even a bit sexy how different he was. So ancient and small, like the male of some turtle without a shell species. She pulled her knee to the side and shifted up her bottom in an unmistakable present posture, the sunlight hot on her exposed vulva.
"What amazing mud," he said, staring at the glop in his hand. "I've never seen anything like this biome."
"No."
"Do you like it?"
"This biome? I suppose so. It's a bit hot and overgrown, but interesting. It makes a change."
"So you don't object? You're not a red?"
"A red?" She laughed. "No, I'm a wig." He thought that one over.
"Do you mean to say that greens and reds are no longer a contemporary political division?"
She gestured at the elephant grass and sal trees backing the meadow. "How could they be?"
"Very interesting." He cleared his throat. "When you go to Uranus, will you invite a friend of mine?"
"Maybe," Zoe said, and shifted her hips back a bit. He took the hint and after a moment leaned forward and began to massage the thigh nearest him. It felt like a monkey's little hands on her skin, clever and knowing. He could lose his whole hand in her pubic hair, a phenomenon he appeared to like as he repeated it several times and got an erection, which she held hard as she came. It wasn't like being tabled, of course. But any orgasm was a good thing, especially out in the sun's hot rain. And although his handling of her was basic, he didn't exhibit any of that hankering for simultaneous affection which so many of the old ones had, a sentimentality which interfered with the much more acute pleasures that could be achieved one person at a time. So when her shuddering had stilled, she rolled on her side and took his erection in her mouth. Like a little finger, she could wrap her tongue entirely around, while giving him a good view of her body. She stopped once to look herself. Big, rich, taut curves, and saw that the span of her hips stood nearly as high as his shoulders. Then back to it. Vagina dentata. So absurd, those frightened patriarchal myths. Teeth were entirely superfluous. Did a python need teeth? Did a rock stamp need teeth? Just grabbed the poor creatures by the cock and squeezed till they whimpered, and what were they going to do? They could try to stay out of the grip, but at the same time it was the place they most wanted to be, so that they wandered in the pathetic confusion and denial of that double bind, and put themselves at the risk of teeth anyway, any chance they got. She nipped at him to remind him of his situation, then let him come. Men were so lucky they weren't telepathic. Afterward, they took another dip in the lake, and back on the sand he pulled a loaf of bread from his day pack. They broke the loaf in half and ate. "Were you purring then?" he said between swallows.
"Mm-hmm."
"You had the trait inserted?" She nodded, swallowed.
"Last time I took the treatment."
"The genes are from cats?"
"From tigers."
"Ah. It turns out to be a minor change in the larynx and vocal cords. You should try it. It feels really good." He was blinking and didn't answer.
"Now who's this friend you want me to take to Uranus?"
"Ann Claiborne."
"Ah, your old nemesis."
"Something like that."
"What makes you think she would go?"
"She might not. But she might. Michelle says she's trying some new things. And I think Miranda would be interesting to her. A moon knocked apart in an impact and then reassembled. Moon and impactor together. It's an image I'd like her to see. All that rock, you know. She's fond of rock."
"So I've heard."
Russell and Claiborne, the green and the red, two of the most famous antagonists in all the melodramatic saga of the first years of settlement. Those first years. A situation so claustrophobic, Zoe shuddered to think of it. Clearly, the experience had brecciated the minds of all those who had suffered through it. And then Russell had had even more spectacular damage inflicted later on, as she recalled. Hard to remember. All the first 100 stories tended to blur together for her. The Great Storm, the Lost Colony, Maya's betrayals, all the arguments, affairs, murders, rebellions, and so on. Such sordid stuff, with scarcely a moment of joy in the whole thing, as far as she could tell. As if the old ones had been anaerobic bacteria, living in poison, slowly excreting the necessary conditions for the emergence of a fully oxygenated life. Except perhaps for Ann Claiborne, who seemed, from the stories, to have understood that to feel joy in a rock world, you had to love rock. Zoe liked that attitude, and so she said, "Sure, I'll ask her. Or you should, shouldn't you? You ask and tell her I'm agreeable. We can make room in the diplomatic group."
"It's a free Mars group?"
"Yes."
He asked her questions about Jackie's political ambitions, and she answered when she could, looking down her body and its curves, the hard muscles smoothed by the fat under the skin, hip bones flanking the belly, navel, wiry black pubic hair. She brushed breadcrumbs out of it. Long, powerful thighs. Women's bodies were much more handsomely proportioned than men's. Michelangelo had been wrong about that, although his David made a best case for his argument. A flyer's body, if ever there was one.
I wish we could fly back up to the rim, she said.
I don't know how to fly the bird suits.
I could have carried you on my back.
Really?
She glanced at him. Another 30 or 35 kilos.
Sure.
It would depend on the suit.
It's amazing what those suits can do.
It's not just the suits.
No. But we weren't meant to fly. Heavy bones and all, you know.
I do.
Certainly the suits are necessary, just not sufficient.
Yes.
He was looking at her body.
It's interesting how big people are getting.
Especially genitals.
Do you think so?
She laughed.
Just teasing.
Ah.
Although you would think the parts would grow that had increased use, eh?
Yes. Depth of chests have grown greater, I read.
She laughed again.
The thin air, right?
Presumably. It's true in the Andes, anyway. The distances from spine to sternum in Andean natives are nearly twice as large as they are in people who live at sea level.
Really? Like the chest cavities of birds, eh?
I suppose.
Then add big pecs and big breasts. He didn't reply.
So we're evolving into something like birds.
He shook his head.
It's phenotypic. If you raised your kids on Earth, their chests would shrink right back down.
I doubt I'll have kids.
Ah, because of the population problem?
Yes. We need you, Issei, to start dying. Even all these new little worlds aren't helping that much. Earth and Mars are both turning into anthills. You've taken our world from us, really. You're kleptoparasites.
That sounds redundant.
No, it's a real term for animals that steal food from their young during exceptionally hard winters.
Very apt.
We should probably kill you all when you turn 100.
Or as soon as we have children.
She grinned.
He was so imperturbable. Whichever comes first.
He nodded as if this were a sensible suggestion. She laughed, although it was vexing, too.
Of course it will never happen.
No, but it won't be necessary.
No? You're going to act like lemmings and run off cliffs?
No. Treatment-resistant diseases are appearing. Older people are dying. It's bound to happen.
Is it?
I think so.
You don't think they'll figure out ways to cure these new diseases, keep stringing things along?
In some cases. But senescence is complex, and sooner or later...
He shrugged.
That's a bad thought, Zoe said.
She stood, pulled the dried fabric of her singlet up her legs. He stood and dressed too.
Have you ever met Bao Shuyo? He asked.
No, who's she?
A mathematician, living in Da Vinci.
No. Why do you ask?
Just curious.
They hiked uphill through the forest, from time to time stopping to look after the quick blur of an animal. A big jungle chicken, what looked like a lone hyena standing looking down a wash at them, Zoe found she was enjoying herself. This Issei was unteasable, unshockable, and his opinions were unpredictable, which was an unusual trait in the old, indeed in anyone. Most of the ancient ones Zoe had met seemed especially bound in the tightly warped space-time of their values. And as the way people lived their values was in inverse proportion to how tightly they were bound in them, the old had ended up Tartuffes to a man, or so she had thought, hypocrites for whom she had no patience at all. She despised the old and their precious values, but this one didn't seem to have any. It made her want to talk more with him. When they got back to the village, she patted him on the head.
That was fun. I'll talk to your friend.
Thanks.
A few days later, she gave Ann Claiborne a call. The face that appeared on the screen was as forbidding as a skull.
"Hi, I'm Zoya Boone."
"Yes?"
"It's my name," Zoe said. "That's how I introduce myself to strangers."
"Boone?"
"Jackie's daughter."
"Ah." Clearly, she didn't like Jackie. A common reaction. Jackie was so wonderful that a lot of people hated her.
"I'm also a friend of Sax Russell's."
"Ah." Impossible to read what she meant by that one.
"I was telling him that I'm on my way to the Uranian system, and he said you might be interested in joining me."
"He did?"
"He did. So I called. I'm going to Jupiter and then Uranus, with 2 weeks on Miranda."
"Miranda?" she said.
"Who are you again?" "I'm Zoe Boone."
"What are you, senile?"
"Miranda, you said?" "Yes, 2 weeks, maybe more if I like it."
"If you like it?"
"Yes. I don't stay places I don't like."
Claiborne nodded as if that were only sensible, and so Zoe added mock solemnly, as if to a child,
"There's a lot of rock there."
"Yes, yes." A long pause. Zoe studied the face on the screen, gaunt and wrinkled like Russell, only in her case almost all the wrinkles were vertical, a face hacked out of wood. Finally, she said, "I'll think about it."
"You're supposed to be trying new things," Zoe reminded her.
"What?"
"You heard me."
"Sax told you that?"
"No, I asked Jackie about you."
"I'll think about it," she said, and cut the connection. So much for that, Zoe thought. Still, she had tried, and therefore felt virtuous, a disagreeable sensation. These Issei had a way of pulling one into their realities, and they were all mad, and unpredictable as well. The next day, Claiborne called back and said she would go. In person, Anne Claiborne proved to be indeed as withered and sun-dried as Russell, but even more silent and strange. Waspish, laconic, prone to brief, ill-tempered outbursts. She showed up at the last minute with a single backpack and a slim black wrist pad, one of the latest models. Her skin was a nut brown and marked by wens and warts and scars where skin disorders had been removed. A long life spent outdoors, and in the early days, too, when UV bombardment had been intense. In short, she was fried. A bakehead, as they said in Ekkus. Her eyes were gray, her mouth a lizard slash, the lines from the corners of her mouth to her nostrils like deep hatchet chops. Nothing could be more severe than that face. During the week of the voyage to Jupiter, she spent her time in the little ship park, walking through the trees. Zoe preferred the dining hall or the big viewing bubble where a small group gathered in the evening watch to eat tabs of Pandorf and play Go, or smoke opium and look at the stars. So she seldom saw Anne on the trip out. They shot over the asteroid belt, slightly out of the plane of the ecliptic, passing over several of the hollowed-out little worlds, no doubt, though it was hard to tell. Inside the rock potatoes shown on the ship's screens, there might be rough shells like finished mines, or towns landscaped into beautiful estates. Societies anarchic and dangerous, or settled by religious groups or utopian collectives, and painfully peaceable. The existence of such a wide variety of systems coexisting in a semi-anarchic state made Zoe doubt that Jackie's plans for organizing the outer satellites under a Martian umbrella would ever succeed. It seemed to her that the asteroid belt might serve as a model for what the entire solar system's political organization would become. But Jackie didn't agree. The asteroid belt was as it was, she said, because of its particular nature, scattered through a broad band all around the sun. The outer satellites, on the other hand, were clumped in groups around their gas giants and were certain to become leagues because of that. And were such large worlds compared to the asteroids that eventually it would make a difference with whom they allied themselves in the inner system. Zoe was not convinced. But their deceleration brought them into the Jovian system, where she would have a chance to put Jackie's theories to the test. The ship ran a cat's cradle through the Galileans to slow down further, giving them close-ups of the four big moons. All four of them had ambitious terraforming plans and had started to put them into action. The outer three, Callisto, Ganymede, and Europa, had similar initial conditions to deal with. They were all covered by water ice layers, Callisto and Ganymede to a depth of 1,000 kilometers, Europa to a depth of 100 kilometers. Water was not uncommon in the outer solar system, but it was by no means ubiquitous either, and so these water worlds had something to trade. All three moons had large amounts of rock scattered over their icy surfaces, the remnants of meteoric impact for the most part, carbonaceous chondrite rubble, a very useful building material. The settlers of the three moons had, on their arrival some 30 years before, rendered the chondrites and built tent frameworks of carbon nanotubes similar to that used in Mars's space elevator, tenting spaces 20 or 50 kilometers across with multi-layered tent materials. Under their tents, they had spread crushed rock to create a thin layer of ground, the ultimate permafrost, in some places surrounding lakes they had melted into the ice. On Callisto, the tent town built to this plan was called Lake Geneva. This was where the Martian delegation went to meet with the various leaders and policy groups of the Jovian League. As usual, Zoe accompanied the delegation as a minor functionary and observer, looking for opportunities to convey Jackie's messages to people who could discreetly do something about it. This particular meeting was part of a biannual series the Jovians held to discuss the terraforming of the Galileans, and so good context for Jackie's interests to be expressed. Zoe sat at the back of the room next to Anne, who had decided to sit in on the meeting. The technical problems of terraforming these moons were big in scale, but simple in concept. Callisto, Ganymede, and Europa were being dealt with in the same way, at least at the beginning. Mobile fusion reactors were out roaming their surfaces, heating the ice and pumping gases into early hydrogen-oxygen atmospheres. Eventually, they hoped to create equatorial belts where gathered rock had been crushed to create ground over the ice. Atmospheric temperatures would then be kept near freezing so that tundra ecologies could be established around a string of equatorial lakes in a breathable oxygen-hydrogen atmosphere. Io, the innermost of the Galileans, was more difficult but intriguing. Railgun launchers were firing large missiles of ice and caldates down to it from the other three big moons. Being so close to Jupiter, it had very little water, its surface made up of intermixed layers of basalt and sulfur, the sulfur spewing out onto the surface in spectacular volcanic plumes, driven by the tidal action from Jupiter and the other Galileans. The plan for Io's terraformation was more long-term than most, and was to be driven in part by an infusion of sulfur-eating bacteria into hot sulfur springs around the volcanoes. All four of these projects were slowed by the lack of light, and space mirrors of tremendous size were being built at Jupiter's Lagrange points, where the complications of the Jovian system's gravitational fields were reduced. Sunlight would be directed from these mirrors to the equators of the four Galileans. All four moons were tidally locked around Jupiter, so their solar days depended on the length of their orbits around Jupiter, ranging from 42 hours for Io to 15 days for Callisto. And whatever the length of their days, they all received during them only 4% as much sunlight as the Earth. But the truth was that the amount of sunlight hitting the Earth was stupendously excessive, so that 4% was actually a lot of light when it came to visibility, 17,000 times as much as the full moon on Earth, but not much heat if one wanted to terraform. They therefore were cadging light any way they could. Lake Geneva and all the settlements on the other moons were located facing Jupiter to take advantage of the sunlight reflected from that giant globe in the sky. and flying gas lanterns had been dropped into the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, clusters of them igniting some of the planet's helium-3 in points of light that were too brilliant to look directly at for more than a second. The fusion burns were suspended before electromagnetic reflecting dishes that put all the light out into the planet's plane of the ecliptic. Thus, the banded monster ball was now made an even more spectacular sight by the achingly bright diamond dots of some 20 gas lanterns wandering its face. The space mirrors and the gas lanterns together would still leave the settlements with less than half the sunlight Mars got, but it was the best they could do. That was life in the outer solar system, a somewhat dim business all around, Zoe judged. Even gathering that much light would require the manufacture of a massive infrastructure, and this was where the Martian delegation came in. Jackie had arranged to offer a lot of help, including more fusion behemoths, more gas lanterns, and also Martian experience in space mirrors and terraforming techniques generally, through an association of aerospace co-ops interested in obtaining more projects now that the situation in Martian space was largely stabilized. They would contribute capital and expertise in return for preferential trade agreements, supplies of helium-3 culled from Jupiter's upper atmosphere, and the opportunity to explore, mine, and possibly join terraforming efforts on Jupiter's clutch of smaller moons, all 18 of them.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 15 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 16.